Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. I am a PGY1 transitional year resident. This is the 58th episode of the Divine Intervention podcast. And in this episode, I'll be doing the seventh part of our neurology clerkship shelf review. So let's just jump right into it. So the first question says, discussion of the pathway slash information carried by the three high-yield spinal cord tracts. So that's like the dorsal column, medial meniscus system, the spinal thalamic tract, and the cortical spinal tract, right? So let's talk about this real quick. So the dorsal column, medial meniscus system carries information relating to like fine touch, vibration, and proprioception, okay? And if you sort of want to talk about the pathways, I think it probably makes sense to discuss them in the context of the upper and lower extremity, right? So for the lower extremity, we have those fibers coming in, carrying that information. They first ascend in the spinal cord, okay? And the fibers, I mean, you see them as they constitute like the fasciculus gracilis if you're dealing with the lower extremity. And then for the upper extremity, you have something known as the fasciculus cuneatus, okay? Both in the dorsal, like the more dorsal part of the spinal cord. But those fibers don't synapse yet. They continue their journey. They ascend ipsilaterally, okay, to the caudal medulla, and then they make their first synapse, right? So the second order neurons for fasciculus gracilis that deals with the lower extremity, we have nucleus gracilis. And then for fasciculus cuneatus that deals with the upper extremity, we have nucleus cuneatus, okay? So you have those fibers synapse, and then after that, those fibers decussate, decrust, as the fibers of the medial meniscus, and then continue all the way up contralaterally, very high yield contralaterally, and go all the way to the thalamus, okay? And then they synapse in the thalamus, and then the third order neurons, right, they go from the thalamus to the post-central gyrus. Very high yield to know that it's not the pre, it's the post-central gyrus, because those are sensory fibers. And then for the spinal thalamic tract carries pinprick, so like pain and pinprick information and temperature information. And the way that tract works is, again, kind of the same deal, carries that pain and temperature information. Only problem is it actually, when it gets into the spinal cord, it actually synapses almost immediately, although it can rise like one or two levels, whatever, that doesn't really matter much. But basically it would synapse almost immediately when it gets into the spinal cord. After initially comes in, initially comes into the spinal cord as Lissauer's tract, rises one or two levels, doesn't really matter, and then it synapses immediately. And then those second order fibers, they cross in the anterior white commissure of the spinal cord, and then they ascend contralaterally, okay, as the fibers of the spinal thalamic tract. And it's actually very high yield to know that they travel in the lateral brain stem. Not the medial brainstem, lateral brainstem, unlike your dorsal column medial meniscus system that actually travels in the medial brainstem, okay? And then again, going back to the spinal thalamic tract, ascends in the lateral brainstem contralaterally, goes to the thalamus, synapses there, okay? Third order neuron, then starts from there and again, goes to the postcentral gyrus because those are sensory fibers. And then for the cortical spinal tract, right, it carries motor information, right? So that starts in the precentral gyrus of the cortex, right? Because again, remember, those are motor fibers. And then those fibers continue down ipsilaterally. They go through like the interpeduncular fossa, blah, 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 blah. And they all travel medially in the brainstem until they get to the medulla, okay? And then you have something known as the pyramidal decussation. Those fibers decussate at the level of the medullary pyramids, at least 90% of them, okay? And then those fibers continue downwards to the dorsal part of the spinal cord. They keep going, get to the ventral horn of the spinal cord and synapse on anterior horn motor neurons that then send fibers, right? Remember, like your somatic nervous system, basically those are the lower motor neurons. They go to your skeletal muscle. Okay. Now, the Romberg test, right? So the Romberg test is really, many people say, oh, it's a test of a cerebellar function. It's not. Okay. The Romberg test is a test of dorsal column function. Okay. Basically, it's a test of proprioceptive ability. And the thing is, to know where you are in space, you need three things. You need two out of three things to be working. The three things are your vision, your vestibular system, okay, and your dorsal columns, okay. Out of those three, you need two out of three to not fall over, right? The Romberg test is just where you close your eyes, stand together, and boom, you can fall. You either stay standing or you fall off, right? So the thing is, say for example, a patient has tertiary syphilis, right, and they have tibis dorsalis. Tibis dorsalis knocks out your dorsal columns. But those people, they walk around just fine, no problem, because two other things are working for them, vision and the vestibular system. When you then tell those people to close their eyes, you take vision out of the equation. So it's now just one of those three things that are working, and then they topple over. It was a test developed by a physician back in the day. I think his name was like Dr. Romberg, to sort of screen people for tertiary syphilis. And to test cerebellar function, you can do those things that you've probably learned in your physical diagnosis courses in med school, where you can tap your hands rapidly on your laps, right? That's like testing for dysdiadochokinesia, right? Or you can do the finger-to-nose business, or you can tell people to sort of like take the heel of their legs and sort of rub it up and down along their lower extremity, right? And then the homunculus, right? The homunculus, don't forget that if you're looking at the homunculus, right? On the lateral side of your homunculus, you have your face. And then on the medial side, right? Sort of like descending down the fork cerebri is your leg area, okay? And then kind of in the middle, you have like your upper extremities, okay? Very high yield to know that in the context of localizing lesions with vascular insults in the brain. And then truncal ataxia is indicative of a lesion to the cerebellar vermis. Okay, cerebellar vermis. Very high yield to know that. Now, the circle of Willis, right? So I'm going to discuss this. That's question two. And pathology is associated with vascular insults, right? So let's talk about the circle of Willis. So basically, the circle of Willis is, it's a, you know, high yield thing you want to know for exams. So let's talk about it and pathologies associated with vascular insults, right? And then we'll talk about one high yield cranial nerve association. So the circle of Willis starts as the vertebral arteries, right? They come off of the subclavian. So you have the vertebral arteries, they come together, okay, to form the basilar artery. But before they come together to form the basilar artery, they give off two arteries, right? They give off your AICA, your anterior inferior cerebellar artery, okay? And then they give off your anterior spinal artery. Okay, and then they join together from the basilar artery. The basilar artery gives off pica, the posterior inferior cerebellar artery. And then the basilar artery continues. Okay, you have like some paramedian pontine arteries formed along the way. And then you have the superior cerebellar artery. Okay, and then after that, you form the posterior cerebral artery. And then the posterior cerebral artery joins up. Sort of gives off the posterior communicating arteries bilaterally that then join up with the anterior cerebral artery. And then those two anterior cerebral arteries are kind of joined together by the anterior communicating artery. So what are the high yield things you want to know about these different arteries, right? So let's start with anterior spinal artery. The thing is the anterior spinal artery, right? If you have an infarction of that artery, you have problems with your medial medulla. Okay, I've talked about this in one of the previous neuro podcasts, but you have issues with your medial medulla, okay? So you have like cranial nerve 12 problems, right? So your tongue will like deviate towards the side of the lesion. You will also have contralateral hemiparesis, right? Because you have involvement of your corticospinal tract. Remember, that goes in the medial brainstem, okay? And then if you have issues with, let's assume you get a weird question about a patient that is getting a triple A repair, okay? In the process of repairing a triple A, you can actually, so that's like an abdominal aortic aneurysm, okay? You can infarct an artery known as the artery of Adamkiewicz. The artery of Adamkiewicz is a precursor artery to the anterior spinal artery, kind of a little lower in the spinal cord. So if that happens, you can actually get something known as anterior spinal cord syndrome, okay? Where basically you lose every spinal cord function with the exception of your dorsal columns. That's another high yield thing to know. But that's more of a spinal cord pathology as against the cerebrocortical pathology. And then if we go further to AICA, I mean, sorry, yeah, pica, sorry, pica, the posterior inferior cerebellar artery, okay, pica, remember those come off the vertebrals, okay, pica supplies the lateral medulla, right, so if you have an infarct of pica, you would have issues with cranial nerves 9 through 12, okay, I mean, sorry, cranial nerves 9 through 11, you won't have problems with cranial 12, and the reason is, again, remember, cranial 12 runs in the medial medulla, not in the lateral medulla, so you'll have problems with cranial 9, okay. So you can have problems with like your jaw, like I mean like your uvula, or you can have problems like tasting stuff in the posterior third of your tongue. You can have like shoulder droop from like cranial 11 issues, right? Stuff like that. And then if we go on to AICA, if you have a problem with AICA, you have a problem with your lateral pons, okay, remember AICA comes off of the basilar artery, you have problems with your lateral pons. If you have issues with your lateral pons, basically cranial nerves 7, 8, basically cranial nerve 7 and 8 will be all screwed up, and also cranial nerve 5, okay, and the reason you have those problems is because you have a lateral pontine problem, right? Remember, cranial 6 runs in the medial pons, but all those other like 5, 7, and 8, they all run in the lateral pons, right? So you have problems with like facial droop and all that badness. You will have, you actually have pain and temperature problems as well, okay? Because your spinal thalamic tract runs in the lateral brainstem, okay? And one other high yield thing you will actually get is Horner syndrome, okay? Horner syndrome, because your hypothalamo sympathetic pathway also runs in the lateral brainstem. In fact, any lateral brainstem syndrome will cause problems with pain and temperature because the spinal thalamic tract runs in the lateral brainstem. You will have problems with Horner syndrome because your hypothalamo sympathetic tract, right, the thing that does the superior cervical ganglion business, runs in the lateral brainstem, okay? And you have problems with the specific cranial nerves that run in the lateral brainstem, okay? Again, it's very high yield to know that. So if you have like a pica infarct or an AICA infarct, those are lateral brainstem issues. Those will all cause those associated problems in addition to the cranial nerve deficits. I promise you may say, oh, Divine, this is low yield, no one cares. Trust me, I would actually not take your NeuroShelf exam if you don't know this thing I'm talking about. You will get localization questions where you have to actually use this knowledge. Same thing with your medicine shelf, your surgery shelf, and your step 2 CK exam. So you might as well just go ahead and learn this pretty well right now, and also on step 3 as well. I'm saying this because I've seen questions like these on all those kinds of exams. Okay, so if you infarct your basilar artery, that person is in trouble, right? Your basilar artery controls so many high-yield functions, right? But basically, your pons is gone. Or if you have like a paramedian pontine artery lesion, your medial pons will be gone, right? Your paramedian pontine arteries, so for example, you can imagine a person having like an abducens nerve issue with that, okay? Although that is rarely, if ever, tested on exams. And then the next set I want to discuss are the superior cerebral and posterior cerebral arteries. In fact, I'll sort of discuss the one high-yield cranial nerve association right off the bat. The thing is cranial 3, the oculomotor nerve, crosses between the, it's kind of like a sandwich. It's between the superior cerebellar artery and the posterior cerebral artery. High yield to know that. And I'll say some weird stuff about cranial 3 down the line. Okay, so, and then the posterior cerebral artery, remember that it supplies the primary visual cortex, right, in the occipital lobe, okay? So if you infarcted that, you have cortical blindness, right? But don't forget that you basically lose vision in every part of the eye with the exception of the macula, because remember, the macula gets collateral blood supply from the middle cerebral artery, okay? Which is a branch of the internal carotid. Okay. So, and then the posterior communicating artery, the high yield thing I want you to know is that it runs alongside the oculomotor nerve, that's cranial 3. So if you have a PCOM aneurysm, okay, that can actually compress cranial 3, at least the fibers on the outside for starters, okay? So, and the fibers on the outside are the things that carry parasympathetic function. So those people can basically lose their, what is it called? They lose their, papillary light reflex, at least the efferent limb of the papillary light reflex. Okay, and then the anterior communicating artery, it's important, right? Because it's the most common location of aneurysms in the circle of Willis. Okay, and then your anterior cerebral arteries. If you infarct your anterior cerebral arteries, right? Obviously, if you sort of think of the homunculus, remember your anterior cerebrals. This is why the homunculus is high yield. Your anterior cerebrals run kind of like in the middle of the cerebral cortex, right? So they supply the leg area of your homunculus. So if you have an ACA infarct, you have issues with your legs, okay? You have like motor and sensory issues with your legs. Again, super high yield to know your homunculus. Okay, next slide. So headache that is worse with sitting upright and better with lying down after a lumbar puncture. So this is something called a post-lumbar puncture headache. Some people call it a spinal headache. Basically, it arises because you have like a CSF leak, like a persistent CSF leak after a lumbar puncture. The pathophysiology basically involves, if you have like a CSF leak, that lowers your intracranial and intraspinal pressures, okay? Because those pressures are maintained by your CSF. So if you have a leak, those pressures will be low. And I sort of think of the brain and the spinal cord sort of like banging up against other structures because there is not that nice warm fluid around them. So you can get a spinal headache with that. The way you treat that is it's usually self-limited. You usually don't need to do anything. But if it's not going away after like a while, right, you can do like a blood patch, okay, to sort of patch up that CSF leak. And then the second thing you can do is you can actually give caffeine. Caffeine actually works pretty well for these spinal headaches. Next slide. So what is causing the cranial 3, the oculomotor nerve lesion, right? So the first one says isolated mydriasis with sparing of other cranial 3 functions, right? So if you just have mydriasis, right? Remember, I told you that, I think I mentioned this in a previous podcast, that the oculomotor nerve, cranial nerve 3, has fibers on the outside and fibers on the inside. The outside fibers carry the parasympathetic functions, right? So like accommodation, papillary constriction, and then the inner fibers carry the motor fibers, right? So like the somatic motor fibers, okay? So the stuff that controls all those extraocular muscles like inferior oblique, inferior rectus, superior rectus, medial rectus, and the levator palpebrae superioris, right? So if you have just isolated mydriasis, you want to think about a compressive lesion from the outside, right? So like a PCOM, a posterior communicating artery aneurysm. Although, I mean, obviously, if the aneurysm gets bad enough, right, you compress the outside fibers and then compress the inward fibers. But if you see like isolated mydriasis, the number one thing I want you to think about on your exam with regards to the oculomotor nerve is a PCOM aneurysm. Next one is down and out pupil without mydriasis, right? So now, if you have a down and out pupil, that means your extraocular muscles have been knocked off, right? But your parasympathetic muscles are just fine, right? So that will arise more from an ischemic lesion. Remember, arteries occasionally run inside nerves. So let's say a person has like diabetes. That's the classic demographic on exams. So patient has diabetes and then they have like ischemia of the oculomotor nerve, okay? That can specifically target the inward fibers, right? So they won't have mydriasis, but they'll have issues with the other cranial 3 functions, the most somatic motor functions that deals with the extraocular muscles. And then if a patient has down and out pupil, plus notice, these are all different things that are causing the same cranial nerve issue, right? So you can see how this is just tempting for the MBME. Next one is down and out pupil plus mydriasis plus weakness of the other extraocular muscles plus sensory loss over the forehead. That's kind of weird, right? Because it's like you're having cranial 3 problems, right? But you're also having weakness of all the other extraocular muscles, or pretty much most of them. And then you're also having sensory loss over the forehead, right? So what's the cranial nerve that controls sensation over the forehead? Well, I hope you're telling me that it is the trigeminal nerve. The trigeminal nerve, right? Its first branch, the ophthalmic nerve, okay, controls sensation over the forehead, okay? So if you see that cluster of symptoms where you're seeing like trigeminal nerve problems, you're seeing cranial 3 problems, you're potentially seeing cranial 4 problems and cranial 6 problems, right? That all tells you that, okay, these are all structured. This lesion must be in a spot that carries all those things, okay? Which happens to be the cavernous sinus. So if a patient has cavernous sinus thrombosis, they can have this specific deficit. This specific lesion is in the cavernous sinus. Next question says, down and out pupil plus mydriasis plus contralateral motor paresis. Okay, so if you're having cranial 3 problems, but you're also having contralateral motor problems, then you know this has to be a cortical issue, right? Most likely at the oncus. Okay, remember, so if you have like an oncal herniation, for example, that's the classic way this presents. The oncus can compress cranial 3, okay, but it can also compress the brainstem. And if you compress the brainstem, right, you can screw up your corticospinal tract. But remember, that's prior to the decussation, so you have a contralateral motor paralysis. So make sure you can explain why all these deficits sort of match up with these four different locations. Next slide. So differentiating between an upper motor neuron and a lower motor neuron cranial 7 lesion, right? So the facial nerve. So this is high yield, obviously, right? That's why it's in this slide, right? So if you have an upper motor neuron cranial 7 lesion, okay? In fact, you know, let's put it this way. Let me talk about the last point on this slide. I think that will help a little more. That will help a little more. So let's talk about a subtle principle relating to upper motor neuron versus lower motor neuron cranial nerve, lower cranial nerve deficits versus lower motor neuron cranial nerve deficits. Okay, so here's the deal. Whenever people think about and I've talked about this in a previous podcast, actually, whenever people think about upper and lower motor neurons, they just think of the corticospinal tract, right? They're like, oh, upper motor neuron goes to the anterior horn of the spinal cord or the ventral horn of the spinal cord, same business. And then you send fibers to the neuromuscular junction. Big deal, okay? The thing you should try to not forget, right, is that, yeah, there's skeletal muscle everywhere in the body. But, you know, there's also skeletal muscle in the head and neck, okay? And just like the skeletal muscles of the body need lower motor neurons, the skeletal muscle of the head and neck also needs lower motor neurons. Those lower motor neurons for the skeletal muscles of the head and neck are cranial nerves, okay? Cranial nerves are the lower motor neurons for the skeletal muscles of your head and neck. So, if your cranial nerves are lower motor neurons, right? First off, you should know that that means they're derived from the neural crest. High yield to know that, with the exception of cranial 2. Cranial 2 is actually an outgrowth of the diencephalon, so it's derived from neural tube. But those lower motor neurons, right, they stands to reason that they should have upper motor neurons, okay? But those upper motor neurons are not known as the corticospinal tract. You know, as the corticobulbar tract, okay? Corticobulbar tract, okay? So the same way that the upper motor neurons for the corticospinal tract travel, decussate, and then go to the lower motor neurons, corticobulbar tract works the same way. The fibers start in the cerebral cortex, they travel down, they decussate, and then they synapse on the nuclei of the respective cranial nerves. So if you have an upper motor neuron cranial nerve issue, okay, you will have contralateral problems, okay, because you have those contralateral problems because those fibers ultimately decussate before they synapse on the nuclei of the associated cranial nerve. But if you have a lower motor neuron cranial nerve issue, you will have ipsilateral problems, okay, because those fibers don't decussate, right? They go from the nucleus straight to the associated skeletal muscles in the head and neck that they innervate. But there's one exception to that, I know. So the one exception is the trochlear nerve. The trochlear nerve is the one lower motor neuron cranial nerve that decussates in the brain. So it gives crossed findings. So if you have a left cranial 4, left trochlear nerve lesion, you have problems in the right eye, okay? So let me make this even more annoying. And again, I apologize in advance. But let's assume you have an upper motor neuron trochlear nerve lesion, right? We said that the upper motor neuron, that's just the way it works, it will decussate. But we said that cranial 4 also decussates it as well, right? So that's like a double cross kind of issue. So if you have an upper motor neuron trochlear nerve, let's say you have a trochlear nerve lesion on the right side of the cerebral hemisphere, right? That will screw up your left trochlear nerve, right? If you have a left trochlear nerve issue, that will screw up your right eye, okay? So I mean, the superior oblique of your right eye, right? So that means that upper motor neuron trochlear nerve lesions, okay, affect the ipsilateral eye. Lower motor neuron trochlear nerve lesions affects the contralateral eye, okay? It's a high yield exception to none. Okay, so now let's go back to differentiating between an upper motor neuron and a lower motor neuron cranial 7 lesion, right? So the upper motor neuron cranial 7 lesion that arises in the setting of like a cortical infarct or something, right? The thing is, you have a contralateral issue, again, because remember, those upper motor neurons will decussate. You have a contralateral, like, facial droop, but that facial droop will actually just be for the lower face only. It will not be for the upper face. And again, I've discussed all this stuff in a previous podcast, so I'll move a little quickly through this, okay? The reason that you have contralateral droop of just the lower face, even if your facial nerve controls all the muscles of facial expression, is that to wriggle your forehead, that function is controlled by the frontalis muscle. The frontalis muscle is one of those skeletal muscles of the head and neck. The frontalis muscle actually has bilateral innervation from basically, like, there are two upper motor neurons, right? For cranial 7, right? There's the upper motor neuron on the right that goes to the left cranial 7. There's the upper motor neuron on the left that goes to the right cranial 7, okay? Those upper motor neurons, both of them, go to the fibers of cranial 7 that control the frontalis muscle specifically. So because there's bilateral innervation, you literally have to infarct the whole brain to get, like, an upper motor neuron cranial 7 problem that will affect both the upper and lower face. But let's assume you don't infarct your whole brain. Let's assume you infarct one side, okay? You will just have contralateral lower facial droop, okay? But in addition to that, right, if you wanted to localize that smartly, right, if you know that you're infarcting one part of the brain, right, you have hemiparesis on the same side as the lower facial droop, right, because your corticospinal tract will also be screwed up, right? So to make sure you can convince yourself that that is true. Okay, but a lower motor neuron cranial 7 lesion will screw up both the upper and lower face, okay? So you have a droop of both the upper and lower face, okay? High yield to know that. Now, the common causes of Bell's palsy, right? Bacterial cause, you're thinking of Lyme disease, Borrelia burgdorferi, right? Carried by the Ixodes tick. Remember, the Ixodes tick, I think, also carries a Babesia microti. Remember that Maltese cross business in your red cells, and also anaplasma. Okay. And then viral cause, you're thinking of herpes. Okay, in fact, some people for Bell's palsy, I've actually seen them get acyclovir. Okay, has, like, some benefit. Bell's palsy also, usually steroids help. Okay, although for the most part, Bell's palsy resolves on its own, right? So the way we present on the exam, a person will not be able to, like, close their mouth on one side. They won't be able to close their eye on one side, right? So for those people, you want to, like, patch that eye or put, like, eye drops, right? So that they don't dry out the eye and destroy it, right? And then inflammatory causes, right? So, like, multiple sclerosis, sarcoidosis. Sarcoid is actually a pretty common cause of Bell's palsy. So Bell's palsy is basically a lower motor neuron, a cranial 7 issue, okay? And then the cranial nerve that's most susceptible to elevated ICP, that will be your abducens nerve, okay? Cranial nerve 6. Okay, next slide. 55-year-old female presents with a severe headache that appears to be concentrated over her right eye. Okay, that's bad news. She has a history of jaw pain when chewing nuts and proximal shoulder pain. So jaw pain when chewing nuts, right? So that's jaw claudication. And proximal shoulder pain that was relieved with low-dose prednisone. I'm hoping you're thinking of polymyalgia rheumatica, okay? So this lady has temporal arteritis, right? And your next step in management, they will always put an answer that says to do a temporal artery biopsy. Don't do that, okay? You need to give high dose of corticosteroids, okay? And then after that, you can then do a biopsy of the temporal artery. You may say, oh, divine. But if I do a biopsy of the temporal artery late, I will be missing out. No, you're not. You can actually do this biopsy up to, like, 72 hours later, I think, and you still get good results from the biopsy. And this will be more of a step 3 question, or I guess a medicine boards question. But if you biopsy one temporal artery and it's negative, the biopsy is negative, your next step in migration is actually to biopsy the temporal artery on the other side, okay? On the other side, even if that's not the side that has the issue. And the elevated serum markers, it's an inflammatory disorder, right? It's a kind of vasculitis. So your ESR and CRP will be elevated. Okay, next slide. 39-year-old female with a past medical history of MS presents with severe left eye pain and decreased vision. The right and left eye do not constrict when light is shown in the left eye, right? So hopefully this gets you thinking of optic neuritis, okay? Optic neuritis is an inflammation of cranial tube, right? So the afferent limb of your pupillary light reflex, it's not going to work, right? Remember, if you have a problem with the afferent limb, a cranial tube lesion, right? If you shine light in the eye that has the problem, patient has like left eye pain, so the problem has to be the left eye, right? You cannot carry that afferent, basically the information relating to the pupillary constriction, the pupillary light reflex does not go in. So if no information is coming in, remember, the information comes in through cranial two, and then it projects bilaterally from the pretectal nucleus to both cranial nerve three. So remember, cranial three constitutes the efferent limb of the pupillary light reflex. So if cranial two is all screwed up, then you're not bringing the information in. So that bilateral projection to cranial three on both eye, in both eyes, doesn't happen. And if that doesn't happen, right, you will not have pupillary constriction of either eye when you shine light in the affected eye. Okay, so this is optic neuritis. You make the diagnosis by, you know, doing like a slit lamp exam. And then the way you treat this is with corticosteroids. Now, next question says, 65-year-old male with a past history of diabetes. That's high yield history to note there. So past history of diabetes and coronary artery disease presents with a 5-day history of decreased vision and floaters in his right eye. Okay. Fundoscopic exam reveals retinal venous engorgement and diffuse hemorrhage. So if a patient is having decreased with a history of diabetes for like 5 days, they're having like decreased vision, and then you do a fundoscopic exam and you're seeing floaters and you're seeing like retinal venous engorgement, diffuse hemorrhage, I really hope you're thinking about a retinal detachment. Remember, in diabetic retinopathy, right, you form all this like weird blood vessels in the eye, and all those weird blood vessels in the eye can begin to exert like a pulling force on the retina. So that can actually cause a retinal detachment. And really, the way you make this diagnosis, you can do like an ultrasound of the eye, actually. Or you can do like ophthalmoscopy, if you may. But an ultrasound is just fine. You can make the diagnosis pretty well. And really, the way you treat this is you can do like a laser vitrectomy. You can do something known as a sclerobuccal. You can inject like gas bubbles or something like that into the eye. Those things all work, okay? You basically want to reattach the retina, right? And that's pretty much how that's taken care of. But let's assume we have this same patient, right? Again, notice they have a history of coronary artery disease, presents with sudden loss of vision in his right eye, okay? Fundoscopic exam is notable for optic disc pallor, okay? And a cherry red spot on the macula. I really hope you're thinking about a central retinal artery occlusion. In fact, I have an ophthalmology podcast that you should probably listen to before you take your medicine exam, before you take your surgery exam, before you take your neuro exam, and before you take step 2 CK and step 3, okay? I talk about all these ophthalmologic pathologies in that podcast. So this is a central retinal artery occlusion. You make the diagnosis with, you can do like a CT angiogram. That could work. And another thing you want to do is you want to do like a Doppler ultrasound of the carotid arteries, right? Because many things that have that cause like a central retinal artery occlusion, the emboli usually start from like the carotid arteries and then sort of flick off to the central retinal artery. Okay, so this is how a central retinal artery occlusion presents, right? So like fundal pallor, I mean, optic disc pallor, cherry red spot on the macula, right? But if you see like a blood and thunder appearance in the eye, that's more of a central retinal venous occlusion. And really, the way you treat CRAO is you basically begin to massage the eye, okay? And you can permanently lose vision. Remember, this is a painless vision loss. You can permanently lose a vision. And the way you sort of want to like fix that is you want to inject TPA into the blood vessel directly. Okay, so that's something you want to call your interventional guys for. And then the next question says transient loss, but your initial step in management is to just, you know, ocular massage. Okay, and then you it's an ophthalmological emergency. People can lose their vision within 2 hours permanently. Next one says transient loss of vision in the same patient with a curtain, with a return to baseline after 10 minutes. Right, so this is like a TIA of the eye almost. And he says that he felt like a curtain coming down, right? That's amaurosis fugax. And really the potential complication is you could have like a big time stroke in the future. So if a patient has amaurosis fugax, you probably want to go ahead and do like some kind of vascular workup so they can figure out whatever is going on with them. Okay, so you want to check the carotids, blah, blah, blah. Now, next question says time window for TPA administration, right? So if a patient has an ischemic stroke, remember, you don't give TPA for hemorrhagic strokes, right? You will have a bigger problem on your hands if you did that. So don't do that. So if a patient has an ischemic stroke, you try to give TPA within 4.5 hours, okay? That's like the harder cutoff. Although you can also give it up to 6 hours, but that has like some weird criteria where if you can like get directly into the blood vessel, but that's probably beyond the scope of our conversation here. And then in general, the safe drug answer on exams for most strokes is aspirin. Is any kind of antiplatelet drug. It could be aspirin. Sometimes it could be dipyridamol even. Dipyridamol is an antiplatelet agent, right? It's a phosphodiesterase inhibitor. And usually in the question, you'll say like, oh, you hear carotid bruise or something, okay? Usually, I'll say like 98% of the time on exams, aspirin is the safe drug to give. However, if a patient has, if they specifically tell you that the patient has like AFib, okay, and they tell you that, oh, you auscultate the carotids and it's just fine, okay, that is the only time you give an anticoagulant. Notice I did not say antiplatelet, I said anticoagulant. Antiplatelet drugs and anticoagulants are not the same thing, right? So for those people, you give anticoagulants like warfarin, okay, or heparin. That's the only time where that will ever be correct. But pretty much every other time, antiplatelet drugs are the answer, like aspirin or dipyridamol or really clopidogrel. Okay, so next slide. So this just shows you like the visual field defects, right? So like lesion A, if you kill the optic nerve, you're not going to see in that eye, right? So if you kill the right optic nerve, right, the eye labeled right, kill the right optic nerve, you're not going to see in that eye, right? If you have a temporal, if you have a chiasm lesion, right, so like from a pituitary adenoma or from a craniopharyngioma, sometimes an anterior communicating artery aneurysm can actually also compress the optic chiasm. It's actually kind of high yield to know. So if you transect the optic chiasm, right, you have tunnel vision, right? And the pathophys behind that is if you look at this diagram, you're basically killing the fibers that come from the nasal retina bilaterally. Okay, so if you're killing the fibers that are coming from the nasal retina bilaterally, you're gonna kill your temporal visual fields bilaterally. Okay, so that's why you have a tunnel vision, right? So you're losing the your temporal visual fields bilaterally. Okay, tunnel vision. That's known as a bitemporal heteronymous, not homonymous, heteronymous hemianopsia. And then for option C, if you transect the fibers of the optic tract, okay? Remember, the optic tract is the term used when you're distal to the chiasm. If you transect the fibers of the optic tract, right, you have a bitemporal homonymous, okay? Homonymous hemianopsia. The reason it's called the homonymous hemianopsia is that you lose the same visual field in both eyes, right? So if you look at B, right, in B it's called a heteronymous hemianopsia because you're losing two different visual fields. You're losing the left visual field in the left eye and the right visual field in the right eye. That's why it's a heteronymous hemianopsia versus C. That's a homonymous hemianopsia because you're losing the left visual field in the left eye and the left visual field in the right eye. So you're losing the left visual field in both eyes. Okay, that's why it's known as a homonymous hemianopsia. Okay, and you have that if you have lesions distal to the optic chiasm, right? And then if you have like a lesion of like your of your lower fibers, so that's like lesion D. You have something known as basically just reverse things. Although I think actually this diagram, just listen to what I'm saying here. Let's assume that lesion D is a lesion to the lower fibers, okay, of the optic radiations, the lower fibers. If you have lesions of your lower fibers, then your upper visual field will be gone. If you have lesions of your upper fibers, then your lower visual field will be gone, right? So in this case, because the upper visual field is gone, that means you must have had a lesion of your lower fibers, okay? So if you have a lower fiber lesion, you have something known as a superior quadrantanopia, okay? Superior quadrantanopia, right? It's like a quadrant because like a quarter of a circle. And it'll be a homonymous hemianopsia as well, right? Because it's like the other visual field, right? So if you have like a lesion on the right, you lose your left visual field. If you have a lesion on the left, you lose your right visual field in both eyes. Okay, and then option E is if you transect like your posterior cerebral artery, right? You'll spare the macula again because you have a collateral circulation from the middle cerebral artery. And remember that this would have a macular sparing, okay? Because again, remember the macula gets supply from the MCA and the PCA, okay? And again, it will be a homonymous hemianopsia. Okay, now. Question 10. What should you consider as an underlying mass in a child that presents with bitemporal hemianopsia, right? I really hope you're thinking about a craniopharyngioma. There's this pathology professor at the med school I graduated from. He loves to pronounce the full term adamantinomatous craniopharyngioma, okay? But remember, it's a tumor that comes from Rathke's pouch, okay? So classically calcified mass on brain imaging, you have your diagnosis, and it leaks a motor oil fluid. I've talked about that in a previous podcast. In an adult, you're thinking about a pituitary adenoma, likely a prolactinoma, okay? And then in a cerebral cortex stroke, right, the eyes will actually deviate towards the side of the lesion, okay? So why is that? The thing is, I believe I've talked about this in a previous podcast, there's something in the cortex known as the frontal eye field, okay? So let me just describe the pathway real quick. The frontal eye field on the right goes down in the brain, decussates, and then goes to something known as the pyramidian pontine reticular formation, the PPRF on the contralateral side, so like the PPRF on the left. And then the thing is, the PPRF on the left controls cranial 6 on the same side and cranial 3 on the opposing side through the medial longitudinal fasciculus. So why would that be important, right? That'll be important because if, for example, you want to look to the left, okay? If you're looking to the left, if your two eyes are moving to the left, one eye has to abduct your left eye and one eye has to adduct. That's your right eye, okay? So you need one structure that controls both. The one structure that controls both is your PPRF, okay? But the go-between, right, like the thing that talks to the cranial 3 on the opposing side is the medial longitudinal fasciculus. So let's assume you lesion the cerebral cortex on the right, okay? Your left PPRF will be screwed up, right? So your left cranial 6 and your right cranial 3 will not work. So you have unopposed activity of your right cranial 6 and your left cranial 3. So the eyes will deviate towards the side of the stroke, okay? But away from the PPRF, okay? Away from the PPRF, right? So that's what I mean by the brainstem stroke lesion, right? So let's say you have like a brainstem stroke on the left. Your left PPRF will be gone. If your left PPRF is gone, then again, your left cranial 6 and your right cranial 3 would not work. So you have unopposed activity of your right cranial 6 and your left cranial 3, okay? So your eyes will deviate away from the lesion in a brainstem stroke, but your eyes will deviate towards the lesion in a cortical stroke. Very high yield to know that. And the thing is, if you have a stroke in the cortex, right, you have like a contralateral hemiparesis. I've talked about that pathway already. If you also have a stroke in the brainstem, you will also have a contralateral hemiparesis, right? Because again, these are all prior to the decussation, right? So let's just summarize real quick. If you have a cortical stroke, your eyes will deviate towards the side of the lesion. and you have contralateral. So you have ipsilateral deviation of the eye and contralateral hemiparesis. But if you have a brainstem stroke, you have a deviation to the eye to the opposing side. So you have a contralateral eye deviation, but you also have contralateral hemiparesis. Okay, make sure you can reason through that in your mind. If you have any questions, feel free to reach out to me. Now, a patient with a history of MS presents with right abduction nystagmus and impaired left eye adduction. When asked to look to the right, where's the lesion, right? So this is an MLF lesion. This is intranuclear ophthalmoplegia, okay? So it's an ipsilateral MLF lesion, right? So basically the easy answer to this is find the eye that has adduction issues. In this case, it's the left eye. So it's the left MLF that is all screwed up. And then Horner syndrome, you can have the lesion in multiple spots. You can have the lesion in the spinal cord, right? So if you have like a lateral cord of the spinal, lateral horn of the spinal cord issue, right? So like, let's assume you have like a Pancoast tumor. You can have those kinds of problems. If you have a lateral brainstem stroke, I already talked about this. You can also have a Horner syndrome, okay? Okay, and remember, Horner syndrome is ptosis, meiosis, and hydrosis. And remember that your cluster headaches can present with partial Horner syndrome. So you have ptosis and meiosis, but no anhidrosis. And then the last question here, a 19-year-old male visited a chiropractor for some neck massages. So think of like neck trauma. 2 hours ago, he was brought to the ED by ambulance after complaining of right-sided neck pain. Okay, physical exam is notable for right, so he has pain on the right side of the neck. Physical exam is notable for right-sided papillary ptosis and meiosis, right? So he has like a partial Horner syndrome on the same side, okay? There are no left-sided findings, right? So this is just a scenario that you just need to recognize on exams. If a patient has any like neck trauma, right? So let's say they were brushing their teeth too violently, or they were in a motor vehicle accident that involved the neck, right? Or they went to a chiropractor, right? And they got these kinds of problems. You want to think about a carotid artery dissection. Okay, and really the classic findings are you have like ipsilateral neck pain, ipsilateral partial Horner syndrome. Okay, and really the way you diagnose this is you do like some kind of angiography. Most physicians prefer an MR angiogram, right? So like MR angiography, but you can also do a CT angiogram. That's fine as well. And then the way you treat this is you can treat this with treatment will probably not be tested on exams, but you can give like antiplatelet drugs. You usually go to surgery. I mean, sometimes you can do medical management, but sometimes you also do need to go to surgery. Okay, so that's where I'm gonna stop today. I hope you've gotten something from this. I probably will have one more podcast, and that will complete our neuro series, and then you have a complete review for your neuro shelf exams. I wish you all the best, and just a reminder, I also offer private one-on-one tutoring for med school coursework and the step one through step three exams. Okay, just reach out to me at divineinterventionpodcasts@gmail.com, and I can point you in the right direction, and I also review applications and do like application advising. So have a wonderful rest of the day, and God bless. I'll see you in the next podcast.